Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ian Shin. Today on our podcast, we have Charlotte Brooks speaking about her new book, American Exodus, Second Generation Chinese Americans in China, 1901 to 1949, published in 2019 by the University of California Press. Charlotte Brooks is professor of history at Baruch College in New York City. She is an expert on the 20th century United States, Asian America, and the Chinese diaspora. In addition to American Exodus, Charlotte Brooks has also written Between Mao and McCarthy, Chinese-American Political Culture in the Cold War Years, as well as Alien Neighbors, Foreign Friends, Asian Americans, Housing, and the Transformation of Urban California. Professor Brooks's work has appeared in numerous journals, including the Journal of American History, the Journal of American Ethnic History, and the Journal of Urban History, and it has also been reprinted in the Best American History Essays. I hope that you enjoy our conversation today. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're talking to Charlotte Brooks about her book, American Exodus, Second Generation Chinese Americans in China, 1901 to 1949. Charlotte is professor of history at Baruch College, which is a part of the CUNY or City University of New York system. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. Charlotte, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Well, I'm from California. It seems like a long time ago that I last lived there, but I grew up mostly in Northern California. Not, I think, what most people associate with Northern California, Bay Area, but actually in the Gold Rush country, northeast of Sacramento. And I went to college at Yale. And after college, which is really the first time I think I ever encountered any other history rather than U.S. history, I just didn't have that opportunity in high school. I took a lot of different history courses at Yale and just became really intrigued by Chinese history. And after college, I taught English in China at a very, well, it wasn't small, but it was a not very prominent teacher's college in central China near Wuhan, about 2 hours away from Wuhan. And after that, I worked in Hong Kong for about a year. And then I came back to the U.S. to go to grad school in U.S. history. So sort of a long, circuitous journey to get to U.S. history. But in the end, I was sort of got some advice when I was thinking about grad school about maybe looking into this field of Asian American history from a professor who talked to me about, you know, studying it at the university where he was teaching, and I decided against it, but I was sort of intrigued by Asian American history as a growing field. And so that's how I ended up studying Asian American history at Northwestern, although at the time there was no Asian American history program
there. Yeah, I think one of the things that folks who are listening to this conversation might be really excited about is, you know, to hear your reflections on the kind of evolution of the field. I mean, this is your third monograph, and, you know, I imagine many of our listeners will be quite familiar with your earlier work on Asian American suburbanization and on Chinese American politics during the Cold War. So as you sort of look back on, you know, how you got started in the field to now, you know, doing the work that you do. How do you think about the evolution of Chinese American history or Asian American history as a subfield in Asian American studies?
You know, it's kind of interesting that I feel in a way sometimes like a bit of a fossil, because I so when I started at Northwestern, there was nobody teaching Asian American history. And I had initially, when I applied to graduate school, thought about studying the civil rights movement. And I ended up working at Northwestern with Nancy McLean, who's now at Duke. And her field, her major fields were women's history and African American history, and they still are. And it was kind of interesting because I think that my approach to Asian American history was formed through this sort of unusual cohort where I was the only person doing Asian American history among her dissertation students, but I was really influenced by my fellow graduate students and Nancy and some of the other people at Northwestern who were doing urban history. My grad student friends were all working in urban history or African American history. And those fields really, they really influenced how I thought about approaching what I did, but also coming from California, where race looked different than it did in the Midwest, really influenced me as well. And that really, I think a lot of us, you know, we are usually our dissertation is our first book, as it was with me. And a lot of what I was exploring at that time were these influences that I encountered in, at a really exciting moment in Asian American studies, even at Northwestern, we didn't have a program when I started, but the spring before I started, there had been a student hunger strike for Asian American studies. And, you know, the late 90s were mid to late 90s really were a time when that happened at a number of campuses. So I was excited by the opportunity to participate in sort of what I thought was kind of a rebirth of a field that had, you know, gone through ups and downs since really its founding in the early 70s. But at the same time, you know, my methodology has always been much more grounded in influences from other fields of history. And Asian American studies in the years since I really started has moved more in a cultural studies direction, which has been interesting to see and I think is really fruitful. But I've sort of remained very much influenced by social history, urban history, African American history, and the idea of trying to do what I do in a comparative way. And because I really started, you know, when I was in college, I studied Chinese history. That was my focus. And so it's been kind of interesting to see the field curve back towards transnational and international perspectives. For me, that's kind of been a return to where I started, because I you know, I started with China, and now since the second book about Chinese American politics was in a lot of ways as much a book about the relationship between the United States, the PRC, and the Republic of China in the Cold War. And this one, this third book, is really a book. I don't know if I've had people have struggled to characterize it. You know, is it a book about China? Is it a book about US history? We tend to put things in sort of silos, but this one doesn't really fit. But maybe that's where the field is going. I don't know. but it's less, I think, influenced by cultural studies than by perhaps Republican China historical studies and African-American studies.
That's wonderful. Yeah,
urban history.
And reflecting on what you're talking about in terms of your remaining grounded in, you know, sort of social history, and one of the things that is kind of important to, as I understand, a lot of your research is the ability to use, you know, sources in Asian languages, which in this particular book is salient, but also in some of your earlier work. And one of the things that I think has become more of the norm in even in Asian American history is, you know, being able to use, for example, Chinese or Japanese language sources and not just English language sources, which not everyone can do. So I'm curious how you came to that. Was that something that you developed when you were that language skill? Was that something you developed while you were teaching in China after Yale, or is that sort of an ongoing practice for you?
You know, it's interesting. It was sort of the first time I took Chinese language was my senior year in college. I knew at that point that I wanted to at least teach in China, to be able to visit China and work there for a while was my ambition. I didn't really know beyond that. I knew I definitely did not want to go to graduate school at that point, or I thought at all. And so I knew I wanted to go to China, and it was a little late getting to take care of the language part of that. So I took a year of language. I took a year of Chinese my senior year of Yale. And I have to say that it's going to sound insane. The classes were every day. It was intensive, 8:30 to 10:30 every morning. And we were divided up by age group. And I was one of the few seniors taking Chinese. They had us together with the graduate students. A lot of people skipped a lot of the classes. They slept through. And I loved it so much that I was there every day. So it was sort of sometimes like getting private tutoring in Chinese. And, you know, that was the last time I formally studied in a classroom setting. And the rest was kind of a mix of self-taught. And when I was teaching English in China, I did study with students, but that always ended up devolving into English because they were trying to practice their English. So a lot of this has just been sort of studying while I was working, studying when I worked for about 2 months in Beijing at the very end of my time after Hong Kong before returning to the United States. And just, you know, sort of self-taught, but studying, especially, you know, trying to learn to read better. And I feel like that's the one thing I've been able to keep up. I've continued working on that for, you know, since I returned to the United States and especially since graduate school. But I realized I was just in China over the summer and I've been a few times in recent years and my Chinese speaking ability has really deteriorated. And strangely, because so much of what I work on in terms of sources in Chinese is stuff that was produced not just before the establishment of the People's Republic of China, but was created in either treaty ports or in Chinese American communities. I'm pretty able to read a version of Chinese that I sort of feel like doesn't exist anywhere. You know, sort of the language used in newspapers in the United States, which was falling out of favor in China, the language used in transitional moments. So it's a strange way to acquire a language, but I feel like sort of I didn't anticipate that my life or career would take me to academia, but the language learning that I sort of came back to during graduate school when I realized I wanted to do Asian American studies has been such an important part of what I do, but you know, not acquired in any sort of systematic or intentional way, but still very important.
That's wonderful. And it's actually quite, I have to say, inspirational. I think my parents would be quite thrilled to hear you say that to me in the context of this interview, to inspire me to do the same, to keep up with my Chinese. Maybe with that, we can pivot to talking a little bit more about the book itself. I want to start by asking, and you sort of cite this in the acknowledgments, actually, of how you came to write American Exodus. So can you talk a little bit how the project came about?
Sure. It was a little bit circuitous. It partly came out of my teaching and it partly came out of the research for the last book, Between Mao and McCarthy, which is about Chinese American politics, especially in the 50s and 60s. When I was doing the research on Mao McCarthy, I kept stumbling upon mentions in State Department papers, mentions in community newspapers of people who had been in China before 1949, especially before World War II. And you know, I didn't think anything of it at the time, but they kept popping up. And when I was sort of wrapping up my research and writing for that book, I stumbled upon another article in this case, an English language newspaper published by Bill Chang. This is the Chinese American Times. Bill just passed away a few months ago at the age of 103, and he founded the first Chinese American paper in New York that was in English. And he had actually been, he attended college at St. John's University in Shanghai. And he mentions this in the article, and then he mentions, you know, such and such a friend who I studied with at St. John's. And at the time I thought, oh, that's odd, right? You know, you have these Americans who are attending college in China. Maybe I should do an article about St. John's. And then around the same time, when, you know, I was stumbling upon these people, I was also teaching my Asian American history course, which I teach every few years at Baruch. And one of the things I often teach as a primary source in that class is that essay contest. I think a lot of people who teach in Asian American history use
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It was an essay contest. You know that one, right? It was sponsored by the Ginghok Club of New York, a women's Chinese American women's organization in New York City in 1936. And the essay subject was, does my future lie in China or America? And the results, the two winning essays and a lot of response to them, they were published in a second generation English language journal called Chinese Digest, which was published in San Francisco before World War II. And I was teaching these essays, and we had this great discussion in the class about them. And I was thinking of a lot about them in conjunction with other stuff I had just taught about Japanese Americans who traveled to Japan before World War II and did these study tours, and some who went to Manchuria as part of the puppet state of Manchukuo. And just all this stuff was bouncing around in my head. I'd just seen that Bill Chang article. And one of my students came up to me afterwards and said, what happened to these people? You know, did they go to China or did they stay in the United States? And I said, well, you know, I don't really know. I'd always assumed, you know, people talked about this a little bit. There's not much literature that I've seen, but that most people stayed in America. But I don't know. Maybe I'll look around. And over the next few days, I thought, well, why can't I find the answers to this question? And, well, maybe it would be an interesting topic. And who do I know, you know, who might have stayed, who might have gone? And I started to do a little research, and then it just sort of mushroomed from there. And I quickly realized that this was going to be more than an article about St. John's University, particularly because I put together a little spreadsheet just on Excel to try to keep track of people that had gone, that I had some kind of documentation, Chinese American citizens who had moved to China to work or to study or to live. And I'm still maintaining the spreadsheet, and I have 1,200 names on it right now of people about whom I have substantial documentation. But that's the tip of the iceberg, and so that's how really this book started, just from a series of questions and ideas and things I was thinking about, just sort of pulled me in.
That's wonderful, and it's it actually helps us to maybe start to talk about some of these, the lives and careers of these folks. And I want to just kind of, for the benefit of our listeners, mention the book is organized, you know, sort of chronologically. There are 5 chapters in addition to an introduction, a conclusion, and an epilogue. And I want to just sort of lay out the chapter titles real quick. The first chapter is New Lives in the South, Chinese American Merchant and Student Immigrants. Chapter 2 is The Modernizers, U.S. Educated Chinese Americans in China. And then we go to Chapter 3, which really looks at the 1920s, The Golden Age Ends, Chinese Americans and the Rise of the Anti-Imperialist Nationalism. And Chapter 4 is about the Nanjing Decade, Chinese American Immigrants and a Nationalist Regime, really looking at the 1930s. And then Chapter 5 takes us into the Second Sino-Japanese War in World War II, entitled Agonizing Choices, The War Against Japan, 1937 to 1945. With that, I wondered if actually we could start by talking about Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 together, because the way that you compare the profiles of these different groups that end up in different places in China in the early part of the 1900s really helps to sort of set up the rest of the story. So perhaps we can start by just asking you to talk a little bit about the differences between these Chinese American merchant and student immigrants closer to southern China in Hong Kong, and the group that you call the modernizers. What are the similarities and differences between these two groups?
Yeah, that's an interesting question to start with, because really that's the first writing problem I started with. This was initially one giant chapter in which I was going to move very chronologically forward. And then I realized, you know, I'm writing about two groups of people, two distinct groups of people with different goals, different degrees of U.S. education, and you know, really different ideas about what their China would be. So the first chapter deals with people who were U.S. born. And I should mention at the outset that one of the complications of writing a book like this is that there was a lot of unlawful immigration from China to the United States in these years. And that creates a little difficulty in trying to figure out how many people from the United States moved to China, how many Chinese Americans. Because when we talk about citizens, there were a lot of different groups of citizens, people who claimed citizenship. Although born in China, they claimed to derive their citizenship from U.S. citizen fathers. And those were people known as, generally known as paper sons, who were not all derivative citizens, certainly, but many of them were claiming a relationship to an American citizen that they didn't have, right? So almost all the people I look at had pretty well documented, they were documented U.S. citizens through birth certificates and other things. And what I found was that almost all of them, whether modernizers or the people who I call the merchants and students, the vast majority were the children of China-born merchants, Chinese merchants living in the United States, which was the only group of people who were Chinese immigrants who were allowed to bring wives in from China. And so these were this group of people. The size of the Chinese American population, citizen population, because of their birth on U.S. soil, starts to slowly grow, and after the turn of the century, it starts to grow more quickly. And what I found was that, in starting with the people who were what I call the students and merchants, these were people who began to consider moving to China before the turn of the 20th century and in the last years of the Qing Dynasty, which ended in 1912, because by that point, their parents, who had come generally before 1882, but even into the 1890s, you know, these were merchant immigrant strivers, not necessarily wealthy, but they wanted their children to have better lives. And because of the anti-Chinese movement, Chinese Americans were increasingly blocked out of more and more professions, more and more channels for upward mobility. And so this first, not really huge, but sizable generation of Chinese Americans that I placed between about the 1890s and 1910s, their parents increasingly see for them a future interacting with other people of Chinese ancestry and not necessarily in the United States. And because this is before the fall of the Qing Dynasty, is when this chapter starts, the most logical place to do that was Hong Kong. You know, it was this real center of, you know, there are other scholars like Elizabeth Sin, who's written extensively about Hong Kong as one of these central nodes in these overseas Chinese networks that spanned the world. And for a lot of Chinese Americans who decided to emigrate, or they decided to send their children to China or Hong Kong at this time, Hong Kong was a logical place to go. It was a place of social mobility. You did not need access to the traditional Chinese exam system kind of education. And if you had some capital or some education and some English language ability, you would have real opportunities. And for people who had come of age in the United States who had those things in particular, this is a place where you could build a business if you had a little capital. And so people who were merchants or people who wanted their children to be able to move in what I call the overseas Chinese world, they sent their children to Hong Kong before the fall of the Qing Dynasty to get an education or to establish businesses. And that was really the group I started with. Because this is even before the Boxer Uprising in 1900. So this is a time of tremendous flux in China itself. And then the chapter two, which deals with those I call the modernizers, this really starts after 1901, after the Qing Dynasty is trying to recover from the Boxer Uprising, in which the Qing court, through its lot in with the Boxers, had to pay dearly because of the foreign governments, not only foreign military intervened. They sacked Beijing and they imposed this Boxer Protocol on the Qing regime. But the Qing government is trying to save itself at this point through reform, and so it institutes these things called the New Policies that are really attempts to revamp the government, create a constitutional monarchy, but also build infrastructure, develop a completely new education system. And one of the problems they have in creating the new policies is they don't have really any Western-trained people to implement them besides a handful of Western-educated Chinese. And so for Chinese-Americans who have had a high school education or even a college education in the United States, for them, this is a golden moment. They can contribute those skills in their Western education. They can go to China and they can enjoy unparalleled careers, just meteoric rises in the new policies era.
I found that section particularly interesting because I was reading about some of that, some of those trajectories that you describe in chapter two. Some of them are really remarkable where, people graduate from college and then a couple years later end up on a Supreme Court or running, a ministry. And on one hand, you sort of think to yourself, well, that is, good evidence of the opportunities that they see. On the other hand, you might also wonder, how good could they possibly have been at that job? in terms of their contributions, so it really was, striking. I wanted to ask maybe for you to talk about some of the other kind of markers of social difference that may come into play with these two groups. And in particular, you pay consistent attention to the experiences of women, although more of them start to immigrate in the 1930s. But if you could maybe speak to their experiences. And the second dimension that I had thought about in reading about this group of Chinese American expats, if we can call them that, was the fact that many of them seem to have come from mixed race families. Certainly, Tom Lee, whom you mentioned, who some listeners may know as kind of the mayor of Chinatown in New York. One of his sons appears in the story in the history that you tell, and I'm curious whether or not that might have been a significant factor in their experiences. I'm thinking of Emma Tung's work on, multiracial Asian and white individuals, and the fact that maybe Hong Kong was more receptive to this kind of, mixed race ancestry and heritage. How did these kinds of additional sort of dimensions of Chinese American identity play a role in this story in the early 1900s?
Oh wow, that's a great question. It's very complicated. I've tried to sort of take it apart a little bit. So in terms of social markers of difference, one of the interesting things I found, just sort of talk a little bit about that the people I call the modernizers who went to China with a particular aim of using their generally college education or vocational training to sort of build a new China, whether under the Qing Dynasty or later the Republic. Most of them came from urban backgrounds. The people who are merchants and students came from all over the United States, small towns, large cities alike. The modernizers tended actually to be more likely to come from Christian backgrounds. And the women who are able to emigrate and who wanted to emigrate in the early years before the mid-20s, really, and especially the 30s, when a lot of the kind of prescriptions on the basis of gender and who could go start to break down because of economic need. A lot of the women were, in particular, were from Chinese Christian backgrounds, and their parents often encouraged them to emigrate with the idea of, evangelizing China, whether through missionary, straight out missionary church work, or through missionary run hospitals or the YMCA, YWCA structure in China and Hong Kong. And the question of mixed race people in this was also one that, I addressed, and then I took that passage out and then I put it back in. And I found that You know, a lot of this reflected the systems and structures and laws in the United States as much as the reception people got in China. You know, a lot of the people I looked at who were, for Tom Lee's son is a major character in the book. He's this man, Frank Chinglun William Lee. He joins the Nationalist Party, really the predecessor to that, the Tang Wenhui. When he's in the United States, he is a fervent disciple of Sun Yat-sen. His mother is German-American. His father is a Chinese-American leader of a Tang, quite a notorious one in New York, the An Liang Tang, known as the mayor of Chinatown, but also, you know, involved in sort of illicit activities and Tammany Hall activities. And Tom Lee's not Christian, but his son becomes Christian. Apparently, this created some discord between them. But I sort of felt like Frank Lee, in a lot of ways, he seemed to be, I didn't see that his ancestry had much of an impact on the way he was treated initially. I do wonder if it limited his rise within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs after the establishment of the Nationalist government, because he remains part of that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a diplomat for the Nationalists all the way till his death in the early 1950s. In addition, I think one of the more intriguing characters, and one I wish I had been able to find more documentation about, although I did find a lot, was this man, Anthony Li Fong Alo. Also, he is the son of a Chinese father and a Hawaiian mother. I think he kind of offers a clue to how people of mixed ancestry related in where they came from, in his case, Hawaii, and when he arrived in China. I think because, you know, we think of Hawaii as being a sort of a more welcoming place for a more diverse population, but there was a very fixed hierarchy in Hawaii as far as if you were of Chinese ancestry. You know, the professions were basically closed to you until the 30s at the earliest. Alo studied at Cambridge University. He was a trained lawyer, and yet he struggled to find work in Hawaii. And he wanted to increasingly put his future into service of China. He really gravitated to his father's ancestry. And it's interesting because he had grown up in a Hawaii in which Hawaiians were pushed out of government. And this is the time when the United States annexed the islands. I found his trajectory difficult to follow in terms of any obvious connection to his mixed ancestry, but I think a lot of people who were of mixed ancestry found not necessarily full acceptance, but greater tolerance in China, in places that were used to a little more complexity, the Pearl River Delta, Hong Kong, where they're increasingly by the 20s and 30s, and Emma Tong's book talks about this, I think brilliantly, about the rise of an identity that you know, is assertively mixed race. But the meaning of that changes over time, and it changes with the changing politics in China. And so that's not perhaps the clearest answer, but it was something that I puzzled over myself when I was trying to follow the trajectories that people had in China. It was easy to follow some aspects of their identity and how they transformed over time.
Yeah, and that's actually maybe a great segue to jump to chapter three, as you talk about the sort of changing politics in China. And here I wonder if we can maybe home in on a couple of cases. So chapter three, which is entitled "The Golden Age Ends." So of course, there's the presumption that, as you talked about before, there's kind of a, you know, socially mobile, flexible kind of world in which these Chinese Americans in China are operating in and moving around in, that golden age ends. And I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit then about, and I hope I'm not butchering these names, Chu Shui-hui in 1928, Nick Char in 1929. These two cases, how do they illustrate the changing politics of citizenship from the angle of Republican China, but also in terms of the racial nationalism of the United States in the 1920s?
Yeah, well, first of all, I actually don't know if you're butchering the names, honestly, because I can read them in you know, in the Chinese characters, but my pronunciation is the Northern dialect. You know, I don't know how they pronounce their names in Cantonese, but so, you know, just to set this up, when I talk about the Golden Age, that is the age where people like Ahlo or Frank Lee were able to rise to great prominence quite quickly. And by the middle of the 1920s, the Nationalist Party, which had been, you know, back on its heels in the late teens, emerges by about 1925 with the help of Soviet advisors and money. Sun Yat-sen is, you know, signs this thing called the Sun Jaffe Accord with a Comintern agent and Soviet representative, Adolf Jaffe, in Shanghai. And this allows Chinese communists to join the Nationalist Party, and it helps bring in Soviet advisors to the Nationalists and a lot of money to build a military academy. And at the same time, there's a lot of labor organizing and anti-imperialist organizing that's happening in Shanghai with the help of the communists. And so the upshot of all this is that for Chinese Americans who are coming into China in the 1910s, in this very fluid environment where essentially what you have is you have people debating in China about what does it mean to be Chinese? What should a modern Chinese culture look like? And you have increasingly a Western educated China born elite in which Chinese Americans who at least the college educated ones are able to mix, or those who are you know, prominent merchants are able to mix and become part of this elite. This is a very fluid moment, and that fluidity starts to evaporate by the mid 1920s as anti-imperialism becomes the leading cause of the nationalists, and as there's increasingly a debate about acceptable Chineseness. But the central question in chapter three is really citizenship. The nationalists inherited and built upon a concept of citizenship that the late Qing jurists created. And they, in 1909, created this nationality law that essentially said that every person with a Chinese father, and I've also seen it with one Chinese parent, but I think the actual law said with every person wherever born with a Chinese father is a citizen of China. And the Republican governments that followed, they inherited this law, they recognized it, and the Nationalists did as well. By 1925, the Nationalists control Guangdong province. They're on the verge of launching what they did in 1926, this Northern Expedition. And they try to implement this law. And why it matters for the book and for Chinese Americans is that, of course, the Nationalists are in control of the province, Guangdong, which is the ancestral province of the vast majority of Chinese Americans. And so Chinese Americans who emigrate to China, they don't go to Shanghai, and most of them don't go to Shanghai. They go to the South, where they have family, where they have connections, where they have business opportunities. And the issue of their citizenship starts to become a real sticking point. Partly because many of them try to play both sides. They try to use their Chinese citizenship when it's convenient. They use their American citizenship when it's convenient. And why American citizenship is particularly convenient is because in China in the 20s all the way up to the 40s, because of treaties that were really foisted on China in the 19th century, foreign citizens of certain nations, not all of them, but certainly Britain, France, Holland, the United States, and other powerful nations in Japan, enjoyed something called extraterritoriality. And that means that they are not subject to Chinese law. It doesn't mean they can break laws or murder people with impunity, but it means that they are subject to the laws of their own country, so that if they violate a law in China, and it's also a law, you know, in their country, they could be arrested for it, but they cannot be tried in a Chinese court, and they cannot be held in a Chinese jail. And that's why citizenship matters so much. And so Chinese Americans claim as U.S. citizens, they are subject to American law, and they are protected from really arbitrary Chinese law in their minds by extraterritoriality. The Chinese governments had objected to this, but in the South, the Nationalists really make it a policy to refuse to acknowledge Chinese Americans' U.S. citizenship. And so the central story in Chapter 3 is that in 1925, Sun Yat-sen dies. And there is a struggle, not any kind of armed struggle, but there's an ideological struggle within the party that had been moving to the left. It was increasingly radical, increasingly friendly to communism, but certainly not communist. There is a struggle for who is going to be the leader of the Nationalist Party. And the three main people who are potential leaders, none of them are Chiang Kai-shek, by the way, which is the assumption, but none of them are. There's Wang Jingwei, who eventually, during World War II, became the collaborationist leader of the pro-Japan. He was really the puppet leader of the Nanjing government under the Japanese. So he's one of them. The other two are a person who's been forgotten, Hu Hanmin, who's a nationalist conservative. And the third is actually a San Francisco native named Liao Zhengkai, who was very close to Sun and very leftist. Liao Zhengkai was assassinated a few months after Sun died, and a group of cadets from the Soviet-funded Wampo Academy basically flow into Guangzhou and arrest people that they think are responsible for Liao Zhengkai's assassination. And one of the people they arrest is this young Chinese-American student named Chu Xiaowai. Zhao Shihui is the Mandarin pronunciation. He is living with his family, but he was born in New York. He went to high school in New York. He has a lot of brothers and sisters, some half-brothers. And his half-brother was involved in right-wing nationalist activism, ran a newspaper, was close to Sun Yat-sen, but is known for being conservative. His brother, his half-brother, is a guy named Chu Su-gun, gets out of town after Liao Zhengkai is assassinated, basically disappears. So the Wampo cadets arrest Chu Xiaowai and charge him with everything they would have charged Chu Su-gun with. And Chu Xiaowai's brothers show up at the American embassy. They're also the American consulate. It's in Guangzhou. And they say, you know, we're also American citizens. Our brother has registered as an American citizen. He needs the protection of the American government. He's been arrested and he is not subject to Chinese law. He has American citizenship. Well, the nationalists reject this argument. And after about a month, the Guangzhou U.S. consulate also rejects the argument that Chu Xiaowai deserves American protection. Essentially, they had been dealing with cases like this on a lesser basis, not political, but, you know, as things had gotten very, basically social order had fallen apart in parts of Guangdong. Chinese Americans were often caught up in this, arrested, shaken down by local officials, kidnapped, whatever. And American consuls had been intervening in these cases for a number of years, and they decided that they were done with it, that these Chinese Americans did not merit protection. And I put this in the context of what was happening in the United States at this time, where you have the passage of increasingly racial nationalist legislation to bar immigrants and from Asia between 1917 and 1924, and to place strict quotas on immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. So this is a time of growing racial nationalism and xenophobia in the United States, and it's really reflected in State Department policy towards Chinese Americans.
That's one of the, I think, real sort of strengths I took away from the book of, and you know, perhaps listeners have been able to census already, that the way that you move between the different political landscapes in China and the U.S., I mean, having, you know, done a field in modern Chinese history, I still have trouble sort of following, you know, the warlord period and then, all the kind of factions. And I really do appreciate the clarity that you bring to the different political landscape that impinge on the lives of these Chinese Americans in China. But I think, you know, moving us forward to Chapter 4 about the Nanjing Decade in the 1930s and the Great Depression as sort of the context, one of the things that fascinates me is how, in many ways, the Kuomintang or the nationalist government essentially, you know, creates a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? And you write about how during this particular decade, the earlier suspicions of Chinese Americans as kind of politically flexible and convenient and sort of agents of Western imperialism, how that essentially becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of how they shape the loyalties of these people in the 1930s. So how does the in-migration of Chinese Americans to China in the 1930s, how does that look different than the earlier decades, the golden age that you talked about earlier in our conversation?
I should mention, I'm glad I was clear. It's difficult. One of the difficulties of writing a book like this for a largely American audience is trying to give just enough detail on Chinese history without getting people sort of really bogged down in what is often, really difficult to follow details. By the 1930s, I think what is clear is there is a single government that controls most of China's heartland, although interestingly, not Guangdong anymore. So there's still political fragmentation. But immigration from the U.S. to China really does start to look different in the 30s, partly because a lot of the neat distinctions I made in the early part of the book between the modernizers and the student and merchant immigrants, it starts to break down a bit. You have a considerable, really hundreds and probably thousands of people of Chinese ancestry leaving the U.S. for China and Hong Kong in the 1930s because of the Depression, because an already bad economic situation for people of Chinese ancestry, just endemic racial discrimination against them on the job market, gets about 80 times worse during the Depression. At a time when, it's kind of the height of unfairness just to contemplate it, that you have for the first time a numerically significant second generation of people of Chinese ancestry, both on the mainland and Hawaii. So they come of age at a time when there are just no jobs. It doesn't even matter how well educated they are. And so you start to see all kinds of people emigrating to China who in previous years might not have done so. People who didn't have a special skill, who had no capital, who had no particular education or trade, but there's no jobs in the United States. So maybe they can find something in China. It's interesting just to look at the sources for the 30s that you have. I think my favorite are some of the female immigrants whose parents probably 20 years earlier would never have let their daughters move to China, but now in the 1930s are depending on their daughters' earnings in China. And one of the families I look at are the Gu sisters, who go to Shanghai and they establish in the International Settlement, which was a foreign-controlled and policed area of Shanghai, they establish a beauty salon and they quickly find themselves, it's called the American Beauty Salon, pretty basic, and they quickly find themselves in competition with two or three other people who are also from Hawaii, other women who have established beauty salons, right? These are working-class women who come to work in Shanghai because the Depression hits Shanghai and other parts of China quite a bit later than it does the United States. People who would never have considered working in Hong Kong, who would have considered themselves patriotic Chinese, who would never, work in a British colony. But in the 30s, a lot of modernizers of the previous, people who would have been modernizers 20 years earlier, people with American educations, they move to Hong Kong and work for they work in infrastructure, they work as lawyers and doctors, and you just have people working in all kinds of different jobs. I found people who are working as jazz musicians and singers, movie actors, and were running restaurants in Shanghai, all Chinese Americans, some of them well-educated, many of them not. And in addition, a huge number, more than several hundred, I think, Chinese American high school graduates who enroll in universities in China, many of them universities like St. John's University, which I mentioned a while back, where the medium of instruction is English. And for that reason, are really attractive to the business classes of China's cities, especially Shanghai. And a lot of these high school graduates, they go to China to build connections to the business classes of Shanghai, thinking that they'll enter that profession in China because there's nothing for them in America. So you just have people of all walks of life, men and women alike, working in China, now, or when they can find work, and struggling really, but doing better probably in China at least until 34 or 35 than they would have been able to in the United States.
One of the sort of insights that I want to sort of call out for listeners is the idea that, and you write about this in chapter 4, of the idea of these Chinese Americans who settle in Shanghai in the 1930s as not border crossers, but actually border dwellers. And I think that's one way to maybe trace the change over time, you know, for the opportunities that these folks find and then don't find.
And also, you know, you'd asked about the Nationalist Party's relationship to these people. And I think that's a good example, because these were very culturally Americanized immigrants who arrive in China at a moment when the nationalist regime is increasingly narrowing the borders of acceptable Chineseness, especially with this movement called the New Life Movement that was supposed to build a sort of a disciplined, Spartan Chinese citizenry. You know, this is the brainchild of Chiang Kai-shek and his wife. And, you know, Chiang was very influenced by and admiring of German fascism. The idea that the Chinese people needed to, you know, sort of to be more disciplined, but expressed in this very hygienic modernity kind of way, where there were about a dozen rules on buttoning up your shirt and not spitting in the street. But part of the New Life Movement was a very anti-Western trend in it, which was, you know, that Western decadence is undermining the Chinese spirit and must be rooted out. You shouldn't go to Western movies. You shouldn't dance in Western nightclubs. You shouldn't listen to foreign music. And the problem is, for a lot of the Chinese Americans who come to study at St. John's or who go to work, you know, the Goo sisters are a good example. The big specialty at their beauty salon is permanent waves, which doesn't sound like a big deal. But strangely, the New Life Movement, one of the big rules of the New Life Movement was permanent waves are damaging to women and they should not be done. Women should not get their hair curled. They can't wear these dresses. They shouldn't dress in too revealing a fashion. And so the sort of values and habits of Chinese American immigrants are really increasingly crashing into acceptable Chineseness as the nationalists lay it down. And the nationalists don't really offer any way for Chinese Americans to contribute. They used to be able to get jobs in government agencies. Their skills were valued, and increasingly they're not, right? So they are border dwellers because I found that so many of them by the 1930s, the greatest opportunities for them and the place where they feel most at home is sort of in between in these in-between spaces, whether Hong Kong or the foreign settlements, which were actually, you know, foreign controlled spaces, the French Concession, the International Settlement of Shanghai, these places, or even in South China, which was not, it was under warlord control in the 30s. It was these places where the Chinese government could not actually exercise power over them, but they were in a Chinese context, you know. So they had left the United States with all its racial restrictions, but they were not putting themselves under Chinese nationalist control either. They were sort of in this, you know, on the border of those places, but that was really the one place that was where they could feel at home.
Which is a great way of pivoting us to the last chapter, because as war comes, right, the already sort of tenuous, narrow spaces where they're trying to make a life closed, it feels like even further, which sets up some of these what you call agonizing choices, which are which is the title of chapter 5. And I was particularly fascinated, I have to say, with the Chinese American collaborators. And you talk about Russell Chen, who's born in Boston and a second generation U.S. citizen who had immigrated to China in the early 1920s, you know, is beaten when he comes out of the New Asia Hotel, where the sort of collaborationist government had been essentially ensconced for fear of running into Chiang Kai-shek's agents. And what's fascinating to me is how, you know, they're already living these multiple kind of layers of identity, and they add a third one, which is kind of, you know, this sort of passing loyalty, or for some not so passing loyalty, to Japan. So what is Chinese American sort of experience in China look like during the 1940s as we get into the period of the Second Sino-Japanese War and World War II?
I think, like you, I was really fascinated by Chinese Americans who chose to collaborate with the Japanese. And, you know, that means different things at different times. And just the kinds of choices that all Chinese Americans had to make were really excruciating to even research, painful, because, you know, as you mentioned, one of the really the themes of the book is that there's a moment in the teens, really the about 1901 to 1920, 21, where there's this golden age or these opportunities. And after that point, those spaces and the opportunities increasingly shrink. And they begin to disappear when the Japanese invade. And for a lot of Chinese Americans, it's a series of choices that they have to make about loyalty to China as a sort of abstract idea, but loyalty to the nationalists. And do the nationalists represent China? And to many of these people, it seems that not. You know, they decided that their China was something else. When the Japanese and Chinese go to war in Shanghai in 1937, you start to see people making those choices, but also not the same kinds of choices that the substantially sized white American population of Shanghai has to make. Because, of course, America's immigration laws prevent people from, like Russell Chun, actually, from, if he'd wished to return to the United States in safety in 1937, he could not have done so without leaving his wife behind. Because as a Chinese citizen, she was not able to follow him to the United States. The United States prevented, immigration law was very racialized and prevented China-born wives from, you know, living with their husbands permanently in the United States. And there were tweaks to that law, but there were all kinds of moments like that where the U.S. government was making loans to its white citizens to leave Shanghai. But if a Chinese American wanted to bring his or her family, if those people were not eligible to come in under U.S. immigration law, then even the head of household could not, if they were American citizen, could not get a loan. And just all these sort of inequalities that were already built in the immigration law, they visited on desperate people trying to get out. And that really, I think, did shape how people made choices, that some people who were able to fled, who did not have dependents, they left in 1937, 1938. And some of them strangely returned. When peace came to Shanghai, an uneasy peace where the Japanese occupied all but the internationally held areas, a good number of Chinese Americans who had fled to the United States end up going back to Shanghai because in the U.S. they can't find work. The depression and the inequality in that again manifest themselves. But there are people like Russell Chun. I remember when I discovered that he was a collaborator, and it does sort of open up these multiple layers of identity, because he's known by one name in the foreign community. He's a member of all kinds of foreign dominated clubs, the New York University Club, the YMCA, the Y Men's Club. I remember reading about some meeting where he introduces Moxie Soda, the sort of New England product, to people at the American University Club. But a year later, you know, through his wife, he's married into this family that flirted with or openly collaborated with the Japanese. And I think that was his path. He was also friends with some other people who were collaborators. And he throws his lot in with with at least two governments. The first collaborationist government and then the Wang Jingwei regime. But I think very few people realized it was him, because he operated under his Chinese name. And the stories about him were about Chen Zitong, not about Russell Chun. He just sort of disappears from foreign life in Shanghai. But, you know, at the very end of the book, I point out that nobody ever figured it out. And he resumed life under the name Russell Chun in Hong Kong after the war, right? There were other people whose collaboration was more obvious and more well known. And the choices they made were interesting too. I write a bit about the Moy family, and they made many different choices. Herbert Moy, the youngest son of this New York family, he indirectly collaborates. He becomes a broadcaster for a German-owned radio station, a Nazi-owned radio station in Shanghai. His brother, Ernest, flees to Chongqing, where he works with the nationalist government during the war. His sister-in-law, Ernest's wife, Ruth, opens their couple's home, which is in the French concession, to U.S. agents during the war. So she is running a U.S. intelligence agent safe house. Herbert's oldest sister, Alice, or older sister, Alice, and her husband, Alfred, were apparently sort of, you know, kind of soft collaborating with the Japanese, being fairly friendly in order to survive in occupied China. And they had made the choice to go to flee to New York, but they returned for economic reasons, I think. And it's really the spectrum of the choices that Chinese Americans did and could make. You know, do you follow the nationalist government into the far inland of Southwest China? Do you return to the United States? Do you stick it out and hope the Japanese don't take over the foreign-controlled areas? But after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese do take over the foreign-controlled areas. And then if that happens, how do you survive? And to what degree are you willing to collaborate? And are you a true believer in that collaboration? So there's just all these different choices. And you know, people's personal histories, I think, with racism in America, with the U.S. government in China, with the nationalist government in China, and with the Shanghai community, I think are what really determine the choices they ultimately make.
Yeah, thank you for that beautiful summary. I have to say, you know, perhaps in looking at the overall arc of the book, some might find it, a little depressing, you know, of the sort of closing off of the golden age into, you know, a set of agonizing choices. But I think, you know, in hearing you talk about the spectrum of choices and decisions that people make, some for economic survival, some out of, you know, real, you know, solid political allegiance, you know, that it does provide a sense of agency in which people kind of do the best they can within worlds that have been made impossible for them. I wish we had more time to dig into some of these details, because the way that you bring these Chinese Americans in China up to life in this book is just so rich. And I hope folks will have a chance to read the book in detail for themselves. As we start to wrap up, Charlotte, and before we let you go, I wanted to give you a chance to maybe tell us a little bit about what you're working on now. I know the book is basically freshly out, so perhaps I hope you're getting a chance to take a break, but what projects are on the horizon for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I've been thinking a lot about that recently, because this project, American Exodus, I think was the most engrossing project I've ever worked on. It just really sucked me in. I would be happy to continue sort of swimming in this world. And I think increasingly I am sort of looking a little bit more at international, U.S. and the world, transnational. You know, my own career and scholarship arc has been in that direction. So I'm sort of torn between two projects that I think I will probably end up doing both at some variation at some point. One, I'm really interested in just sort of examining the American community in China at the time, you know, in the late Qing and early Republican era in general, not just Chinese Americans, but, you know, just the kind of diversity of small businesses and you know, prostitutes and missionaries. And there's been a lot of focus on the missionaries, not as much on sort of the ordinary people who try to build lives abroad, you know, just a whole number of people who retired to China because it was cheap to do so. You know, it's sort of fascinating. I don't know if there's enough there to sort of build a project on, but it'll be fun to find out. And I think the other one is, you know, to continue looking at what I call in the book the overseas Chinese world in pre-war Asia, especially pre-war China and Hong Kong. I think it's just so interesting, the idea of, you know, I talk a little bit about the, I think you might call it the institutional infrastructure of overseas Chinese life in China, especially South China, in, you know, I talk about Lingnan University, which at the time was Canton Christian College. And, you know, it has students from around the world. It has overseas Chinese school attached to it. And parents of ethnic Chinese parents from around the world send their children to study here, but they study in all kinds of different languages. And it's, it seems sort of, you know, it's distinct from sort of ordinary China. It's just almost this place that's apart. And I kind of like to continue investigating that, although I have no idea how. I have to admit the book did come out like 3 months ago. So I should probably take a breather and spend more time with my family and that sort of thing. But these kinds of questions, I'm not really settled. I really would like to kind of dive back and look more at them.
Well, I love that. And as somebody who's also interested in kind of the intersection between, you know, U.S. and the world scholarship and Asian American history, I think it only adds more to each of those fields by expanding the way that we think about the international dimensions of Asian experiences in the United States and in, you know, places like an overseas Chinese world. So, Charlotte, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It was really a pleasure to get to talk to you about American Exodus. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ian.
That was my conversation with Charlotte Brooks, author of American Exodus, Second Generation Chinese Americans in China, 1901 to 1949, published in 2019 by the University of California Press. My name is Ian Shin, and this is New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.